This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at IKEA-USA.com today.
First, I'm Jenna Wolf. That is the Hall of Famer Chris Carter. This is Nick Wright. How was your weekend?
Great.
Yeah?
Great
good
football.
To see you, brother.
I got a little cold, mate.
Don't do that.
You can't this is so good. Can we just sit in
cold.
The moment
oh,
of,
okay.
yes,
yeah.
you know, he's going to have a cold for the foreseeable future, but it's good. We have a great show today.
Betcha.
We had a big weekend. What?
Betcha you doesn't miss a day of work, though.
Oh, hilarious. You're so funny with your cold jokes. Eight seconds in. One of the best weekends on the sports calendar just happened. We're going to get to all of it. Let us start with Tom Brady and the Patriots hosting the Chargers. Hey, many thought the Chargers were the better team from top to bottom. Patriots clearly did not agree. They dominated this one from start to finish. They won 41-28. Tom Brady threw for 343 yards and a touchdown, while Sony Michel ran for 129 yards and three touchdowns in this one. The Patriots win their advance. They are moving on. But let's stick with this game first. CC, how were the Pats able to dominate against the Chargers?
It was very, very basic. It's about numbers. Football's a game of numbers. Last week, we talked about Gus Bradley came up with a great defensive scheme. I think 57 out of 58 plays, they played seven defensive backs. So you know coming into New England, we had Bart Scott sit here. Bart Scott said, he said something. I'm going to tell him, write it down, because I didn't think they could be successful with seven defensive backs playing against New England. I didn't think New England was going to play 50 snaps where they're going to throw the ball. If they're going to throw the ball 50 times, then that's the perfect type of defense to be able to set up. But you can't do it the whole game. And when they came out in this undersized lineup, which it is undersized, and New England does not have a ginormous offensive line, but what they do have is James Devlin, probably the best blocking fullback we have in the NFL. There's only a handful of these guys.
One of the only actual fullbacks left in
the NFL. They're like dinosaurs. So when you see one of these guys coming, get you that picture I have on my...
Get a neck roll.
Get you a neck
get
roll.
Get ready for some contact.
They're not going to throw the ball to him. He's getting ready to pound you into submission. That's what he does. Right now at this point in his career, regardless of what people want to say, Rob Gronkowski, number one thing he does, end of the line blocker. That's the number one asset that he provides to this New England offense. So you combine that with five offensive linemen. Let me have Devlin and Rockhead Gronk. So now we got seven big guys running against seven defensive backs or six in one. Because part of the time they had a linebacker in there.
No, and sometimes it was eight. Because they had a second tight end out there sometime. I mean, it was so old school. And I know Brady actually, you're going to say, oh, he threw the ball 44 times. Well, yeah, technically that's true. But a lot of those passes were runs, essentially. Mm-hmm. This is what was so frustrating watching the game, see. And this is what confused me. Because I know how smart Anthony Lynn is. I know how smart Gus Bradley is. And I didn't understand why they didn't make an adjustment that seemed obvious watching on television. That when Sony Michel was in the game, they were going to run the football. When James White was in the game, they were going to pass the football. I picked up on that late in the first quarter. It was, and I think, I don't have it, I think the numbers indicate that that was exactly what they did. And the Chargers had no answer. The Chargers had a defensive game plan as if they've never seen the Pats play. As if they were letting Tom Brady just play catch. It was and I know they play a soft zone coverage, so that is schematically what they do. But Brady was never under duress. progress. And the Pats, it looked to me like they were looking at what the personnel was allowing for them to do and said, okay, we will do exactly what you're going to let us do, and we'll get 6 yards at a time.
Or they did, and they said to Kim Evans, hey, we did this against the Ravens, and it worked. Let's do the exact same thing. I'm sure it'll work because our defense is set, even though they have one of the deepest defensive rosters in the league, CC.
Yeah, I didn't think that Gus Bradley, man, he's done a lot on the defensive side. Great game plan, too, going against Baltimore, a team that they had played within the last 3 weeks, so they were a little more familiar with them. With New England, it wasn't as if it was a bad scheme. It's all they had. With their linebackers being banged up, so I'm not going to be sitting here saying, oh, man, Anthony Lynn, the Chargers staff, man, they got out-coached. That's all they had. They were thin at the linebacker spot, and they thought as far as with New England running the ball, they thought they could put more speed on the field and they would be able to get around the blockers. That part was not effective. So I'm not going to be like the Chargers went into this game with the wrong game plan. At the end of the season, when you got guys injured, sometimes it's a matter of what can you do with the players you have, and that's all the Chargers had. They didn't have an answer to what New England was going to do with Gronk and Devlin in the game.
And thanks to our great statistician, Dusty, 35 of the 36 plays that White was on the field for ended up being passing plays. Like, you could tell what the Pats were going to do based on the personnel that they had. And the other thing that happened in this game was the two best front seven defensive players for the Chargers, one of them who was the star of the Baltimore game, Melvin Ingram, and Joey Bosa, who's one of the most talented players in the league, they could not get home at all. Brady got hit one time, got sacked zero times. So the only way that defensive game plan was going to work was if they were getting pressure to Brady with four, which is what they were trying to do throughout. You saw the Pats having zero blitzes. You saw the Pats defensively getting pressure and taking chances. The Chargers were not doing that, and they were not able to get home with their star all-pro level defensive line.
But give it to the Patriots. They also played a better game, at least offensively, than we've seen them play in the last couple of weeks. They came out absolutely dominated against a very good defense. We hadn't seen them. We know they're so great at home, but you haven't seen them play that way where Tom Brady methodically hits everyone, where Sony Michel has lanes to run consistently throughout the game.
Yeah, it's a combination of a couple things. You got to give credit to the Patriots, but it starts with the game plan. That's what we went over before. Starts with the game plan and how we're going to dictate a certain pace to the opposition. Everyone thought New England potentially was going to come out and try to match talent for talent. That's not what they do. They do have talented players, but me and Olivia, who works here on the staff, she went to the game and everything. We're the only two people who seem like had confidence that New England, it's going to be a matter of James White and Sony Michel. That's all it is. Like that's all it is. And when they can concentrate on that, that's how they can look like a championship football team. You know the reason why? They weren't throwing the ball down the field to Hogan. Philip Dorsett, they had him in a couple little matchups and everything. But these guys in the small role that they play compared to trying to play a major role, that was the difference in these games. They're not real deep at wide receiver. They are a better football team when you put them in a phone booth. You took the pressure off of Brady. So when you talk about a play count, he did throw the ball 44 times, but it was when he wanted it. It's with 34 rushes. Typically, if you don't play effectively, you're going to have 44 passes and about 20 to 18 rushes because you're not getting the first downs in the productivity.
And it was, I mean, they ran so many plays because in the first half, they had more first downs than the Chargers had plays. And when you throw the ball 44 times, but 17 of them are to James White, when he has 15 catches for 97 yards, 15 for 97 makes a lot of sense for a running back running the ball. Like that. Right. And so his production plus Sony Michel's production, those were all essentially rushing attempts.
All right, we'll talk about your Chiefs in a second. But right now, the Patriots are on their way to their eighth straight AFC title game. How impressive is that for Tom Brady after the season he's had this year?
I think it's the most impressive thing besides the five Super Bowls. I mean, there's nothing we've seen like this in sports. I've read about Bill Russell. I've read about what he did. I read about John Wooden. Know about the talented players. But I've never seen anything like this. Besides him having those five Super Bowl championships, being able to do this with the type of consistency at the age he's at in a salary cap free agency era, it's the most impressive stat that he has.
Well, the stats that this match up against are the exact two that Chris mentioned. But the only reasons those were able to happen, when Russell was doing it, there were 8, 10, 12 teams in the entire NBA. If you made the playoffs, you were in the conference finals. It just had 4 of the 8 made it at the beginning of his run. Wooden's UCLA teams, when they made all those Final Fours in a row, had the winning streak. There was only 16 teams in the tournament. Like, so for the Patriots to now, Tom Brady, and this stat's going around everywhere, in his 17 full seasons, has made a conference championship game 13 times. So Drew Brees this year, his completion percentage all-time record,
yes.
Tom Brady makes a higher percentage of conference championships than Drew Brees completes
crazy.
A pass. It is. I think 13 conference championship appearances is as impressive as the 5 Super Bowls. Like, you know, pick what you think's the most. Like, the 5 championships, the 8 trips, the 13 Final Fours, and they could add to those first 2 numbers, again, depending on how
well,
they play.
Well, the great thing about it is we don't have to pick the appearances because
sure.
we do have the Super Bowls.
Right.
That's the way. It's about championships. Yeah, the other number's impressive, but if he happened to start off his career like Elway and he had lost a lot of those numbers are totally different compared to, man, I also won it 5 other times.
Go ahead.
No, just the other theme of the weekend is, man, that bye sure helps.
Yeah.
Teams looked healthier. Teams looked more rested. Like, the bye, we said it before during the week, teams with a bye make the Super Bowl about 40% of the time. Teams that play in the wild card round make it about 6% of the time. The Patriots found their way into a bye this year and made the most of it.
There were a lot of doubters and a lot of naysayers for Tom Brady. We'll talk about that in a little bit.
Not me
coming
and
up,
Olivia.
Nope.
Jenna
not
either.
You and Olivia. I was on board too.
Yeah,
but
Jenna was on
let's
board.
Give Olivia some
props. Yeah,
props
we had
right
to drag
now.
You along.
Olivia, coming up. How are the Saints able to pull off the comeback? That's next on First Things First. Welcome back. We're going to get to the Saints' win over the Eagles in a second. But first, Chiefs wide receiver Sammy Watkins makes an impressive one-handed catch yesterday.
Man, forget the catch. I'm so glad that Sammy Watkins was on the field.
Yes.
Man, that was – I watched that report every week, actives, inactives. Because – now, you're talking about a dangerous football team. Kansas City with Sammy Watkins, his ability to be able to catch, play in the slot, and also run some reverses. Oh, man, it was great to see.
When he's the
and by the way, that was a pretty good catch.
And when he's the third weapon on a team, that's a hell of a
Chargers,
arsenal.
Pats, Keenan Allen, Juke, Stephon Gilmore runs free for a 43-yard touchdown.
And from this moment forward, it was a disaster. In this moment, it looked like we were going to get a shootout. Touchdown one way, touchdown the other way. Pats came back and scored. Chargers didn't do anything on offense after this until garbage time.
But it was
time.
A good juke.
Great move by Keenan Allen. They set him up. Phillip Rivers helped him with a little pump fake there. Stephon Gilmore is playing some outstanding football. One of the best corners in the NFL. He gets him on that play. But at the end of the day, we know who gets the last laugh.
Saints Eagles. Marshawn Lattimore climbs the ladder. Big interception in the second quarter.
This, I know we're about to talk about it. This is probably the biggest play of the game. I know it happened early, but this came right after the Breeze fumble that they recovered.
Breezy.
And this was, I mean, the Eagles could have really put their foot on their throats. Lattimore had an outstanding game, and this got him going.
Doug Peterson called a great play here. They had slipped Zach Ertz down the sideline. You can see Nick Foles' feet, they were not clean. He couldn't step into the throw to be able to flight it in front of him, throws it behind him. Lattimore gets back into play and makes a spectacular interception, high point in the football right there, but huge play in the game. If Nick Foles completes this ball, I think we got a different story.
20-0 from that moment forward.
Let's dive into these highlights. Sticking with Drew Brees and the Saints, taking on red-hot Nick Foles and his magic carpet ride. Foles would open up the scoring in the first with a touchdown to Jordan Matthews. Eagles jump up 14-0 early. Everyone big excited. But the Saints would crawl back. Third quarter down 4. Brees finds Michael Thomas in the end zone. He had 171 yards on the day. Eagles with a chance to win it down 6, driving. But Foles finds Alshon Jeffrey, and the ball went right through his hands. Jeffrey can't believe it. Saints win 20-14. Here's their head coach, Sean Payton, after the game.
I'm proud of those guys. I'm proud of that locker room. I fought through a lot and, managed to get the win. And, again, it's these are tough games.
I'll take that loss. That's on me. Let all my teammates down. City of Philadelphia, that's on me. I'll take that.
You win through losses, you win through wins. This is something that, all of us are going to learn from and we'll be better for. I've talked a lot about, my career in the NFL and the ups and downs. You're always learning. And, you know, we learned a lot tonight. And it's tough, but we'll keep moving on.
He's basically already a head coach, just with his post-game comments. CeCe, what was the key to the Saints' comeback in this game?
Well, I think one of the things that's important is the breakdown out of the Alshon Jeffrey catch, no catch there at the end, the ball he dropped. They had a zone route on where he was supposed to go up 5 yards and run a little smash route inside. If they're in man-to-man, he comes out really hard and fast. If they're in zone, he's got to be able to slow down. As you can see, he's right there by the hash mark. He's supposed to catch this ball out right inside the numbers. So that route, I tell you all the time, Nick, 50, 55%, 60% of the interceptions.
This one is 100% on the receiver.
And it's not because he dropped the ball. It's because of where he was and in relationship to the defense. If it was man-to-man, he should have been way in there running away from the defender. Then there wouldn't have been anybody back there to even catch the deflection. Again, zone, he's got to be able to sit down right there to be able to make that catch. So that was the decisive play in the game. But there were a number of plays in the game. We talked about the Ertz, the underthrow, where they got the interception in the game. But I just believe that second half, because the momentum had already switched, that second half, first possession, where the Saints had the longest drive that I had seen since I've been watching football.
See, how about 120 yards on that drive? Because of penalties.
Yes.
Like, they gained more than the full football field in that drive. They at that point had full control of the football game.
Yes. And at that point, you could see the confidence in the Eagles, the magic for which they were doing. The Saints had regained that. In none of these divisional games did we see the home team get off to a slow start, but the Saints game. And the Saints were able to recover.
Why do you think that was? Why do you think
they have the biggest home field advantage? Their fans at no point will ever give up on the Saints because of their relationship, because it's a strange season ticket base. Most of the people, because they just don't have the bill to afford, the bill to pay for season tickets, most of their season, they walk up to the game, 60% of the tickets, and buy them that day. Now, you can't do that in the playoffs, but it is a love affair with a team and a franchise that they never thought would win. But then came Katrina. Then came the block punt. Mm-hmm. Drew Brees, Sean Payton. So they've changed the whole culture there. So it's just not it's a loud building. It's just not that they have a good – because it's loud all the time. They've had some bad seasons there in New Orleans. But, man, the relationship they do have with those fans allows them to stay in the game. In Philadelphia, they were well represented as far as being at the game. But that, to me, was one of the critical moments, because either team can win that game. But as you said, after that drive – the Saints were in complete control of the football game.
All right, so I want a lot to break down here. One is the most critical play. This is the cruelty of sports now. Alshon Jeffrey in week 13 said, "I have the best hands in the league," in his career in the playoffs. Prior to that play, had been targeted 34 times, zero drops. And on that play, which, by the way, speaking of cruelty, they didn't even have to run it. That play went off at 2:01. The clock was their friend at that point in time. If it hits the two-minute warning, they're not in bad shape at all. But the reality is the Saints for the last 2 years, or the Eagles, pardon me, every bounce has gone their way. It bounces in games they're not even playing in. The Minneapolis Miracle, they're not even in that game, but it went their way that the Vikings won and they didn't have to play the Saints last season.
Yes.
In a must-win game against the Houston Texans when they're down, Jadeveon Clowney gets a penalty on Nick Foles that supercharges that drive. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the double doink in the game last week.
Right.
And then Will Lutz. Michael Bennett makes a great play. The biggest play of the game up to that point. And then Will Lutz misses the kick. But I thought the biggest sequence and was started right before the Foles interception. And they're up 14-0. They force a fumble on Drew Brees, and they have it. Like, they have it so much, the refs thought it was a recovery and then another fumble. But they don't fall on it. And so now it's a punt instead of you have the ball inside the 20 and then the Foles interception. But the reality is, the right team won, because after the first quarter, this was a total and utter annihilation. In the first quarter, the Eagles had 153 yards, the Saints had 21, and it was 14-0 Philly. The rest of the game, it was 399 yards to 97 yards. The Saints defense, what they did to this Philly offense in quarters 2 through 4, was as good of any defensive performance we've seen by any team all year. They shut them out and they shut them down. And that's why Drew Brees and the offense didn't have to be brilliant. They were very methodical. They didn't make mistakes after the first couple drives, but they didn't have to be perfect because that defense was spectacular after the opening two Eagles touchdowns.
How do you think Nick Foles played yesterday?
I thought Nick Foles played pretty good, but you can't throw interceptions. Like, you can't underthrow the Zach Ertz ball right there. Nick Foles, I like the fact that his understanding of football, where he throws it on the field, the different receiver he's throwing the ball to. So I think when you start evaluating Nick Foles, you have to look at, man, he understands the game of football, understands what coverages and stuff are trying to do. Turnovers ultimately are going to kill you. And at that time of the game where Ertz, if he's able to make that completion right there, I believe the game is totally different. The momentum never gets flipped back over to the Saints. So that was a key part of the game. They became one-dimensional. Even though they had the lead, they wouldn't run the ball, and that became ultimately, I knew that would be a problem. Saints defense, so you got to give a lot of credit that they were able to contain Nick Foles in that offense after that first quarter.
All right, we'll talk much more about Nick Foles and what we see as the future for him coming up. But time now for Put a Grade on It, sponsored by CarMax. Drew Brees, as we mentioned, had a great day. He went 28 for 38, 301 yards, two touchdowns, a pick in the win last night. Nick, put a grade on Drew Brees' game.
You got to give him an A. Didn't panic at first. I mean, first play of the game goes about as poorly as one can. He throws an interception on the very first play before he really has a chance to get into the game. They're down 14-0. Didn't panic. I thought played really well throughout, and his team won. So I give him an A.
Yeah, started off with that pick. The reason why I wasn't worried about the pick was because he had Teddy Ginn open for a touchdown. Underthrew him, couldn't get enough on the throw. Bounced his team back. Him, Sean Payton, undefeated. They're playing at home in the playoffs at 6-0. A plus, whatever the professor here, Nick, wants to get.
Right. All right, good stuff. Got to take a break. Coming up, what went wrong for the Cowboys in Los Angeles? That's next. This is First Things First. On to the Chiefs and Colts. And while the Chiefs finish the season with a better record, better offense, better quarterback, they tend to trip up in these kind of games. But Patrick Mahomes, anti-tripping. Not rattled, started strong, finished strong, beating Andrew Luck and the Colts 31-13. Mahomes threw for 278 yards, ran in for a score. So Kansas City advancing to its first AFC championship game in 25 years. Here is Patrick Mahomes after the game.
The defense stepped up big, played great all game long. Offense, we started fast, had a kind of a dry spell, but we finished it off in the end.
Certainly not the start we wanted, and not the middle we wanted, not the finish we wanted. It's a little bit of a tough pill to swallow, but no shame from the guys in that locker room. You know, heads are up high.
We're such a different team. We have such young players that we have so much confidence going in that we're going to win every single game. We want to play at this stadium. We want to win at Arrowhead Stadium. And so we get the opportunity to play here again next week. We're going to come with that same mentality if we're going to go out there and try to win this game one play at a time.
He's exciting. He's exciting to listen to. His energy is exciting, and it's really just fun to be a part of watching him develop into the quarterback we all know he's probably going to be. Nick, in your opinion, what was the most impressive part of the Chiefs' win?
Well, you mentioned Patrick Mahomes, his poise and the fact that the moment clearly was not too big for him, that he made no major mistakes. His worst throw of the day was the one that Sammy Watkins saved for him. That could have been a pick, and Sammy Watkins turned it into a reception. And the drive right after the blocked punt, when it was 17-7 near halftime, and it could have gone either way, and they used the clock. They forced the Colts to use all their timeouts, and Mahomes threw the error with his legs, accounts for 73 of their 75 yards on the most important drive of the game. All that was very good. But the most impressive part to me was this defense continuing to make plays. The Colts, 9 third down attempts, 0 conversions. After the Sammy Watkins fumble, another moment the game could have flipped in the Colts' favor. D Ford comes around the edge, takes the ball away from Andrew Luck. This defense shutting down the Colts' offense for the entirety of this football game, that has to be what was most impressive. A defense that's been better at home than on the road, but still by no means one of the best defenses in football, had as good of a defensive performance this weekend as anybody.
Yeah, I'll give Patty Mahomes credit for playing in the playoff games and being under control. But if look at his stat line, 27 for 41, 278, got sacked 4 times, quarterback rating of 85. If you tell me that before the game, I tell you the Chiefs lose.
Oh.
Those numbers right there, with the Chiefs defense they played with for 16 games, oh, they lose the game. Like, they're not going to have enough productivity, because you think without Kareem Hunt, they're probably not going to have 25 rush attempts. So, bam, they had that plus some, 33 rush attempts there. So, with that stat line, you got to be happy with Patty Mahomes, because he played within himself. He didn't try to force anything. But there's nothing in that game that was more surprising than their defense. Like, this has been one of the historically bad defenses, 5 yards a rush, and their ability to be able to dominate on first and second down. Nick mentioned the third down, but the reason why, because they were winning on first and second down to put them in a position that they could stop them on third. That was the difference between what the Chiefs were trying to do and what the Chargers were trying to do. They weren't winning on first and second down up front, and you got to give credit to that front seven. They physically beat the Colts at what the Colts are very, very strong at. I thought the Colts had the best offensive line, and in that game, the Chiefs were so much better than them up front.
And the Chiefs, you mentioned them running the football. Damian Williams, since he's come in for Kareem Hunt, the Chiefs' per-game rushing production has not dropped off. Now, he is clearly not the pass catcher that Kareem Hunt is, and they love using the running back screen game, and that has been downgraded since Kareem Hunt got cut from this team. But Damian Williams, who got a contract extension a couple weeks ago, has been really good. And I think Mahomes' passer rating is – well, I know that the reason it's 85 and not 105 is because he ran for the touchdown instead of throwing for the touchdown. The only, to me, concern, or the biggest concern in this game was, would Pat Mahomes give the ball to the other team? He hasn't been as turnover prone as Andrew Luck, but we have seen in some of the bigger games this year, he tries to force things, throws an early interception. They avoided that, and they were, because the defense went forced the Colts into three and out, three and out, three and out, start the game, you're up 14-0, and then you can be very cautious, which is what they were the rest of the game. And, I mean, this is obviously a great win for the Chiefs, but it again speaks to what we said earlier. Like, this is the healthiest the Chiefs have been all year. Sammy Watkins got to play. They clearly were rested.
And their defense showed up.
The defense showed up. And all of those things, I don't think any of those things happen without the bye. I don't think any of those things happen on the road. This Chiefs team, the defense, is allowing 35 points per game on the road. They haven't allowed a single 30-point game once at home. They're allowing 18 points per game at home. So the defense has been better at home throughout. It showed up big time on Saturday afternoon.
All right, Chiefs beat the Colts, and for that they get the Patriots, but it will be at home for the Chiefs, so that's great. Let's move on to the Cowboys and the Rams and their divisional matchup. Rams would jump out early in this one. Todd Gurley making it 20-7 with a 35-yard run. He and C.J. Anderson both had over 100 yards rushing on Saturday. Cowboys hung around, at least they tried to, with a little over 2 minutes left to play. Dak Prescott runs in for the score. That cuts the lead to 8. But the Rams wouldn't give the ball back. Jared Goff picks up the 3rd-and-7 with his legs. That would seal it. Rams win 30-22. Here's Cowboys quarterback Dak Prescott after the loss.
It's been a great season, obviously, just all the ups, all the downs. The team that we had are 3-5 and being counted out by everyone, but backs against the wall mentality, the way we were able to fight just to get to where we are right now is inspiring and incredible. All the men on this team, I'm proud of this team, but anytime you lose, especially when you know the team that we have and as close as we felt we were, it's not a good feeling.
What's it feel like to win a playoff game?
Feels good.
Besides that?
Feels good.
Really good?
Real, real, real good. Great, actually.
Okay.
But this ain't we still got one more. Keep winning. We got to keep winning.
Lights must have been really bright in there just for his retinas, just to make sure that. CeCe, what was the key, do you think, for in the Rams win over the Cowboys?
Up front, man, their overall philosophy, they were going to get back. It was nice to see Todd Gurley was healthy. But even beyond that, with C.J. Anderson being added to their roster, you don't think that they're going to take advantage of that and be able to run on the Cowboys. We haven't seen anybody run on the Cowboys like that this year. And up front, there were several teams that really transformed their season by getting away from having a bad offensive line. Seattle, the Colts, and the L.A. Rams. In the last 2 years, all these teams have revamped their offensive line, have a different attitude in offensive line. The Rams' offensive line started all the games last year and started every game this season. So their overall continuity coming into this game healthy. Andrew Whitworth, the left tackle led by them, that rushing attack was phenomenal. And when you can play that physical in a playoff game, it makes the game so much easier for the quarterback. We saw that in the Kansas City game. We saw that in this game where you're not relying on the quarterback to try to lead you to win. It was an old-style football that we hadn't seen all season. It was nice that the Rams were able to adopt that for this playoff win.
And you mentioned when we were talking about the Chiefs that if you'd have looked at, told you Pat Mahomes' stat line before and you said the Chiefs would lose. Well, if you told me before the game Dak was going to throw for 266, no picks, a 99 rating, and Goff was going to throw for 180 and a 74 rating, I said, oh, this worked out perfectly for the Cowboys. They must have been getting pressure to Goff. They were No, they didn't. They didn't get pressure to Goff at all. I thought the one thing we knew was that against this bad Rams rush defense, Zeke would have a big day. Up. Zeke got shut down. 20 carries for 47 yards, one big run the entire football game. And what the Rams were able to do to just amplify C's point, the Cowboys all year had allowed four guys to rush for 70 yards. That's amazing. The Rams had two guys in the first half go for 70 yards. C.J. Anderson, after the game, he had a funny quote. He said, listen, I'm just a fat kid finding the right hole to run through. But he was another Gruden castoff, by the way. He was enormous early in this football game to where they didn't have to use Todd Gurley that much, and they took control. And the Cowboys, we just showed the highlight. Man, their identity, we're going to be tough, we're going to be physical, fourth and one, run it right at them. That was an enormous play in that football game where the Rams got off the field and allowed them to extend that lead.
We talked about how the only path to victory for the Cowboys was going to be short, Zeke runs, and then other things have to happen. It was just assumed that Zeke was going to get his carries and get his yardage, especially against this run defense. But I know you touched on it. What was it that really kept him from being able to be successful?
You could see in the playoffs that the teams that had the bye, they did a great job of self-scouting themselves. What haven't they done well? What do they do well in trying to come up with the game plan? All the teams that had the bye came up with a substantial game plan to be able to. You know something? I was not great at this. And the Rams, and Ndamukong Suh in particular, was phenomenal in this game. Yep. And it won't be by stats. You have to watch the game. He changed the line of scrimmage. He destroyed the center and the guards, and then Aaron Donald when he could, because they had a heavy concentration of trying to double him. So interior-wise, they dominated the Cowboys. The Cowboys' offensive line, typically, we have not had question marks about them, but you left this game knowing that they had been the physical part of the game. They had lost that to the Rams. So that was the best part of the Rams having the bye, Wade Phillips self-scouting himself because they don't have great linebackers. So you would think that the Cowboys were going to run on them. They weren't because of that front took control. They took it upon themselves and said, the Cowboys are not going to run on us. And that was one of the themes with some of these bad defenses, especially run defense that we saw with the Rams and the Chiefs.
The things that, even when the Cowboys weren't playing well early in the year, were most reliable about this team, Zeke's production and their front seven defensively, are the two things that let them down in this game. Their front seven couldn't stop the run and couldn't get any pressure whatsoever. Goff sacked zero times, only hit once the entire game. We've talked about how he was the 28th ranked quarterback in the league when pressured. They couldn't get that pressure. They couldn't establish their line of scrimmage. And so if you'd have told me they were going to lose this game decisively, and they did, they were down 50, they were down two scores a lot of the game, I'd have said Dak didn't play well. Dak played fine. Dak played well enough to get another playoff win. The rest of the team did not do what they had been relying on them to do throughout the season.
All right, let's take a break there. Coming up, how were the Saints able to pull off the comeback? That's next on First Things First. Welcome back. We'll get to the Cowboys' future in a minute, but first, Grizzlies, Rockets, Mike Conley to Garrett Temple, who throws down the dunk. Watch it. Ooh.
Garrett Temple has carved out for himself a really nice career. And it's impressive to me because I didn't see this coming from him early in his career.
Did you see this? Celtics Nets, Jaylen Brown driving down the lane, delivers the big left-handed tomahawk.
Celtics tried to make it a game late. Yep. Brooklyn really played well at home. Celtics minus a couple starters. Jaylen Brown, when he's not getting told off by Kyrie as far as being a younger player, not knowing what to do. Well, he knew what to do on that.
And Jaylen had a little comments for Kyrie after the game. Oh, no.
Big night for Knicks, Syracuse, Orange Men. Duke, Syracuse, Zion doesn't give up perfectly. Time's the block here.
This game, for me personally, couldn't have gone better. because Cuse won, but Zion had a monster game.
Yes.
What a fun game to watch. Duke dealing with some injuries. One, Cam Reddish out with an illness. Their point guard gets hurt early. Syracuse took advantage.
More from this one. Cuse's Elijah Hughes launches a shot from the other side of the court, nails it. Syracuse with a big upset in this one.
And listen, when a game goes to overtime, that shot right there matters quite a bit now.
Oh, yeah. After that shot, the buzzer beater before halftime, didn't score until the opening bucket of overtime. Mm-hmm. So he took a bow after this one and took some time off.
Absolutely.
Chilling.
Moving on to the Cowboys. They finished their season with a loss to the Rams. Overall, good year for Dallas after starting the year 3-5, winning 10 regular season games and getting Dak Prescott and Ezekiel Elliott their first ever playoff win. But according to Cowboys COO Stephen Jones, this team needs to continue to get better in the future.
We've got to build on this, take the next step next year, and think we've got a good young team that can certainly have success. But, certainly we weren't good enough to get the job done. You are what you are, and we got eliminated in the divisional round, and we've got to do better than that.
All right, let's get into a little more specific on how they can get better. How do they build off the season they just had this season?
Well, I think they've got to have an honest conversation with themselves about how good can this team be at its best, because this is going to be their team moving forward. They have a lot of cap space this offseason, about $50 million. That'll go up to nearly $60 million if they move on from Sean Lee. But we can start ticking away at that right now. You want to keep DeMarcus Lawrence? There's about $18 million.
He got franchised this season.
Right. So he either walks or you give him a long-term deal. Maybe they franchise him a second time. But either way, $18 to $20 million. Dak is getting a new deal. We know Amari's getting a new deal. And Zeke probably is getting a new deal. There's your cap space. So they're not going to have to lose any of those guys, right, but
gone.
It's
just
all
like
gone.
That. It sounds good when you start the conversation, but it goes quickly.
And so the keys for the Cowboys are, in no particular order, getting Travis Frederick back, which is wildly important.
Which doesn't involve money.
Right.
It's just his overall health. He's the best center in football. It seems like he's on his road to recovery.
I was going to say, it seems like he will be back and healthy.
This is the hardest, because it's not an injury.
I know.
None of us really understand. Only Mark Schlereth dealt with it, so he has an idea. But
he was full strength after a year.
And so we have reason to believe he'll be back. And I would say the two biggest components for the Cowboys are their other offensive linemen getting back to all-pro caliber form in Tyron Smith, Zach Martin, the guard they took, Connor Williams, justifying that second-round draft pick. And then, of course, as is the case with every Cowboys conversation, where does Dak's play go? Because there are no – they obviously don't have a first-round pick, and they don't have – they're not going to be, I think, big-time players in free agency. It's this team. And now this team you have some faith in because they won 8 of 9 down the stretch, including a playoff game over the Seahawks. But it's not going to be some remake of the team, and it's not going to be a bunch of different faces coming in.
But of all the question marks on the guys that you will have to sign this offseason, Dak seems the one with the biggest question. It was year one. Year two, and then year three was sort of like this, and you want to know which way he's going, but they're going to sign him regardless.
I think Jerry and Steven in the Dallas front office there, they've made up their mind that Dak is going to be their quarterback of the future. It becomes very important, Nick, what he thinks about his future. What's more important? Does he want to try to get in the Kirk Cousins type range as far as money, or does he settle for something a little bit less so that they can put other pieces around him? I believe that the second is the better of the options because of the inconsistency, and if he's going to reach his potential, they're going to need that cap space to be able to put some other players around him. So my suggestion for the Cowboys is you need to be able to enhance your stars and be able to protect your stars. Number one being Dak Prescott. It starts with Travis Frederick and that offensive line. The left tackle. We need to have some heart-to-heart conversation. Is he an elite player? Because if he's not an elite player anymore, what typically happens is I need to see some of that money that he's making because I'm paying him to be an elite player. He's not elite anymore, so I look for them to ask him to take a pay cut. Zeke is going to get an extension. They need to continue to develop their tight end position and add more speed to the offense. If you're able to do that with a tight end and more speed, you help Dak continue to develop as a quarterback, and you help Ezekiel Elliott lengthen his career because you take some of that burden off of him on the offensive side. Defensively, you know Lawrence is a star. You franchised him. He's earned the long-term contract. But what you need to do, the other stars on that defense are their inside linebackers. They need a couple big defensive tackles. They don't need to spend a lot of money on it, but they need big so that these linebackers can run and be utilized in space. For me, that's the remedy to the Cowboys of how they go forward. You have to protect your stars. You have to expect them to continue to get bit better. But how do you do that? You put people in front of them, linebackers. You put those defensive tackles. Dak, you help him out with other speed guys on the outside. And Ezekiel Elliott, you remove some of that burden that him carrying the ball 400 times. Like, is that necessary going forward?
A month ago, when the Cowboys looked positioned to turn their season around, going into that Eagles game, which was, if they won it, they were going to lock up the division for all intents and purposes. I said the Cowboys might look back through hindsight if they win this game and wish they hadn't. And the reason I said it was I thought if they won that game and won the division, it was guaranteed Dak was getting an extension this offseason. Now, to Dak's credit, they won that game. They won the next couple games. They won two of the next three, I should say. They won a playoff game. Dak played, I thought, a very good Dak Prescott game in that playoff game, and he's not the reason they lost against the Rams. He's getting the extension. You guys know my philosophy on if you pay a quarterback franchise money and he is not a force multiplier, the enormous deficit it puts your team into. This is where, no matter whether it's $20 million or $28 million, the money he gets this offseason, whatever he can do to get himself to the next level as a player, he does not have to be one of the five best quarterbacks in football, but he has to be in the argument as one of the six best quarterbacks in his conference. And so that's where he's got, and we know Breeze is there, we know Rodgers is there, Wentz is in his division, but with health questions. And so he needs to come up at least one tick. If he does that, then we know what the Cowboys' blueprint is, and I agree with Chris wholeheartedly. This offseason, even with limited draft capital, tight end and interior defensive line are the two spots that I think allow my other strengths to become even bigger strengths.
I feel like we have this conversation all the time. If he gets a little bit better, if he's just a little more accurate, if he maybe uses his athleticism a little bit, there's a lot of ifs with Dak Prescott. How many quarterbacks have we seen over the last couple years that in their, you know, we look back and we say, well, the first 3 years, the jury was still out, but then in their fourth year, they really took off and became something? Or does it not really work that way?
It only happens at the top of the league. We'll start at the top, Tom Brady. If you look at them in year one, two, and three, let's go to New Orleans and Drew Brees. Both of these guys have the most experience. We have the other young quarterbacks in Patty Mahomes. That's what we forget. We forget the process that players go through. Dak being on one of the teams, one of the marquee teams, and them being part of the conversation as far as the national media, he gets more attention on him. But Tom Brady was no further along than Dak Prescott.
And Ben Roethlisberger either.
Now, Drew Brees was a prolific thrower.
Prolific
thrower in college. But he still was developing his overall arm strength when he was in. And the Chargers gave up on him. Yep. And the Saints, they the one invested, and we saw him continue to grow there. So I believe that Dak is on the right track. Just as easy as they traded for Amari Cooper. Look how much better he got. Now we add another tight end, add some other things to that offense. I believe he can take those necessary steps that Nick's talking about.
I was very concerned with Dak Prescott around the midway point of the season.
Yeah.
When he couldn't crack 270 yards passing in a game, when the Cowboys were struggling, when it looked like the progression was here to here to here. What he did over the last eight games showed me growth to where you can say, okay, continue on that growth path, and it wouldn't be unprecedented, to your question, for him to get where we're talking
about. I think also what we've seen in Nick Foles, I think we can continue to learn. You can see with Nick Foles as a passer, in the last year and a half, he's gotten so much better. He's so much more visually able to see things down the field. He trusts what he's seen. He's got enough arm strength to be able to reach almost all parts of the football field. So that development process, it's hard. It's hard when you have a franchise quarterback and you're trying to help him make those next steps. But we have seen other guys do it. We weren't patient in those times. And typically with Dak, we're not going to be patient watching him develop.
And what Foles had working working for him last year was Frank Reich and Doug Peterson. This year he has Doug Peterson. I don't believe Dak has yet had the great quarterback coach around him. Either the great offensive mind. I think they've been fine. I think Jason Garrett gets criticized all the time. I think he's fine. I wonder this offseason if the biggest move the Cowboys could make is try to do the Sean McVay thing, except not as the head coach, as someone to come in to work with the
offense.
Yeah,
they've already said they're going to bring Scott Linehan back. They've already done that.
And we already know that Jason Garrett, after the way the Cowboys finished the season, is going to be around for a long time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
All right, we got to take a break. Did you guys hear what Marcus Peters had to say? This is going to be great. Wait till you hear what he had to say. His gumbo comments. That's next on First Things First. To the NFL now. Kareem Hunt is still without a team after being cut by the Chiefs. In their end-of-season press conference, the Chicago Bears did not rule out the possibility of signing Hunt, who coach Matt Nagy called a really good kid. Nagy's Kansas City's offensive coordinator for Hunt's rookie season. See, what do you make of this?
This is what it takes. It takes someone, when you have the record that Kareem Hunt, and we don't know what's going to be uncovered in their investigation, you need someone who knew you before. And Matt Nagy, his history there in Kansas City, his experience with him as a rookie, that would open the door for the opportunity. I do believe that with the proper amount of rehab and with some type of penalty from the league, he should be back playing in the league. And I believe that Chicago is one of the likely spots because of that intel that Nagy has with Kareem as a rookie, Nick.
And all off-the-field incidents are not created equal. And I think it should be noted that Kareem Hunt seems to have an anger management problem, and potentially, because there were some other incidents at a bar not involving a woman, potentially a problem with alcohol. He does not, in everything I've read and from people talking to him, fit the profile of a guy that has engaged in domestic abuse, and I think that's one of the reasons a team might take a chance on him.
Finally, Kyler Murray declared for the NFL draft yesterday. While this doesn't close the door on his baseball future, he does keep his options open. All right, CeCe, what do you make of this?
He should keep his options open. The thing that I would be afraid of, if I had his size, because pro sports, it's about size, speed, power. And if you don't have those things, you have to have something else, some type of uniqueness that would make it. Why are they going to play you? Why do they need your skill level? Now, baseball, we've had this argument for a long time. Man, if I could play any sport professionally, I would play baseball. Well, we got a guy that has the potential to be a first-rounder in the NFL and a first-rounder in Major League Baseball, and those two, they've never been done before. And what we saw with Bo Jackson and Deion Sanders is different. Bo Jackson is a running back, and there's no skill set that's more transferable to higher-level playing, high school to college, college to pro, than being a running back. Because you can toss them the ball, hand them the ball, and because their skill set, they can adapt without a lot of practice. Deion Sanders, you don't need a lot of practice for, I got that cat.
Right, cat
and
corner.
If that cat goes over there, I got that cat. So you don't need a lot of practice. Being the quarterback, being the face of a franchise, developing as a passer, you need to be there in the building on a regular basis. So for me, I think I would lean towards him playing baseball because we've never seen someone at his height be successful in the NFL. Now, Mel Kiper, I believe in Mel Kiper as a draft evaluator more than anyone else. And Mel Kiper says he's the most unique prospect that he's ever seen. So that uniqueness, I could understand why a team would take a chance and make him a first-round pick.
Yeah, but unique is not always a complimentary term. So sometimes you're unique because there's never been anyone like you. That's not intrinsically good. Sometimes Jenna's unique in a great way.
Oh,
there you go,
you.
Jenna
the
Wolf.
Best.
But he's unique because Doug Flutie's the only comp. And listen, Doug Flutie was a great story, but was not a great NFL player. Like that, Doug Flutie had one season as a full-time starter, one quality season as a full-time
Buffalo.
Starter. Yes, you were there.
I covered it.
19 touchdowns, 16 picks. The other season he had a chance as a full-time starter with the San Diego Chargers, 15 touchdowns, 18 picks. He was the best he could be in the NFL, was okay. And that's my concern. Even if Kyler's much better than him, University of Oklahoma released yesterday. I don't know why everyone's saying he's 5'8". We measured him this offseason. He's 5'9 in socks. Okay. So you will be the shortest quarterback in the NFL and the shortest in league history, not named Doug Flutie. That is a major, major concern.
When we started this season and throughout most of the season, the thinking and the assumption was that he was going to go play baseball. The A's signed him. It was baseball, baseball, baseball. Then he finishes out the season, plays in the Orange Bowl.
Wins the Heisman Trophy.
Wins the Heisman Trophy. And suddenly it's, well, maybe I'll keep my options open for football. What do you think changed his mind? Was it that he felt he got better as the season went on?
What I've been hearing behind the scenes, and I got a lot of respect for his dad. His dad was a big-time talent I thought should have been even a better pro. Great college player at Texas A&M. We played him, Ohio State played him in the Cotton Bowl. So based on his dad's background, I thought that he would have a love for football. But based on Kyler, what he's telling people is he's good at baseball, but he loves football. That's the reason why, because he played college football after being drafted. Mm-hmm. He told them, I'm going to play in college football. So he did that, and he went out and won the Heisman Trophy. So to me, if the intangible part is, what does the kid want to do? And if you can be a pro in either one, if the kid favors one sport over the other one, that's the one typically they're going to play. Now, what I think is more favorable for him at this point in the NFL, more than any other point, we just got 8 new coaches, and I'm just going to tell you, we are getting ready to see more Saturday football on Sunday in the NFL. So now would be the time to have someone.
This is the only time in NFL history, to me, he would even be considered a possible first-round pick. Like, I mean, look back to Charlie Ward. Now, I understand Charlie Ward wasn't quite the athlete that he was. Yes. Charlie Ward won the Heisman, said, I got to go play basketball. No one's even going to give me a shot playing quarterback. So, this is the time to do it. If he were 2 inches taller, but he's not. So I think he's going to end up a baseball player.
Yeah, Mel Kiper said if he was 3 inches taller, he'd be the first pick in the draft. Now, not only the influx of college and what they're doing in the pros, but the rules in the NFL.
Sure.
Now there's not a better time for a small guy to play because the game is less physical.
So easy, just some lifts in your cleats and you're 3 inches
taller.
Hard to
run like that.
I think Tom Cruise does that. Mm. Hey, back to the NFL playoffs.
Eat that, Tom Cruise.
Did I just give away a little Tom Cruise secret? Back in the playoffs where the Rams are heading to New Orleans to face the Saints. These two teams played earlier in the season. The Saints handing the Rams their first loss in 2018. Rams cornerback Marcus Peters has been waiting for the chance at revenge ever since. Had some spicy things to say to Saints head coach Sean Payton after that Week 9 loss. Take a listen.
Tell Sean Payton, keep talking that shit. We gonna see him soon. You feel me?
Fair enough.
Yeah, because I like what he was saying on the sidelines too. So tell him to keep talking that shit, and I hope you see me soon. You feel me? And then we're going to have a good little, nice little bowl of gumbo together.
All right, so that was back in Week 9. But on Monday, Peters took to Twitter saying, it's gumbo week, let's eat. I think it has since been deleted. But, CC, how does the Rams' defense match up with the Saints' offense this time around?
I think they have the ability to match up better than what we might have thought going into the season. Because if you look at the way the Rams really concentrate on trying to eliminate Dallas from taking over in the running game. And Ndamukong Suh, Aaron Donald, the rest of that interior, they made a conscious effort. They're not going to run the football on us. So I do believe when people make up their mind that something's not going to happen, and they have the talent to be able to do it. But it really boils down to the back end of this defense. What was the difference in the first meeting? The inability for the Rams to be able to get off the field in third down and their inability to negate big plays of the New Orleans Saints. So Marcus Peters, he's concentrating on Twitter. He need to concentrate on coverages because there's several reasons why he is out of Kansas City. Number one is he's not dependable. All right, and that's meaning on and off the field. You don't know what he's going to say, and he will freelance and guess and drop coverages. We saw that last week's games. We saw that in the first meeting with the Saints. That's one of the things about him. He is a gambler. So how will Sean Payton, and it will be a head game, because Sean Payton will talk trash on the sideline. So this will be a back and forth. If I'm Marcus Peters, I need to concentrate on what I'm doing, because Amari Cooper is not the same thing as Michael Thomas. Michael Thomas being more physical and Marcus Peters wanting to play physical, that's Michael Thomas's game. So be careful if what you're trying to do doesn't play into the strong suit of what Michael Thomas and the Saints and Sean Payton are trying. They will definitely run a couple double moves against Marcus Peters and try to take advantage of his aggressiveness.
So because you're totally right that Peters is the ultimate boom or bust corner. that his first couple years in Kansas City, he led the NFL in takeaways. He burst onto the scene as a rookie, but he also gave up some huge plays. This year, he's had less of the boom and more of the bust, but still some big plays. But the other big difference in that football game is Marcus Peters was less healthy than he is now, and Aqib Talib wasn't there. And so now you all of a
McVay
sudden...
McVay actually said Aqib Talib is the biggest difference between then and now. No, that was the biggest difference.
I would expect Aqib Talib to get most of the time on Michael Thomas. I know we'll talk about this later in the week, but to me, Aqib Talib is better with a physical receiver than Marcus Peters is. I think Aqib Talib, that might be a better matchup. Then you do worry about Teddy Ginn's speed and who's going to deal with that. So there's it's pick how you want to die sometimes against the Saints offense. There's no great answer. But I thought Coach Mangini, and it pains me to say this, made a really great point yesterday about the Rams defense, which is it possible that Ndamukong Suh and others were easing their way through the regular season to get to this moment healthy, to get to this moment ready to go, because they're veteran players on one-year deals knowing we are here to win a championship. If that's the case, that is bad news for everyone, including the Saints, because we know the talent that's on this Rams defense, and if they are able to duplicate what they did rush defense-wise, then those corners are going to have a much easier time in passing.
So something we haven't talked about a lot is the fact that besides Sheldon Rankins, these are two very healthy teams that are matching up, meeting up with everyone available. Is it rare that at this point in the season you get that?
It's very rare. They're not going to make excuses for the injuries, but I think there's a couple things. Andres Pete, the interior offensive lineman, he's dealing with a broken hand, played every snap last week. And we know Teron Armstead, the left tackle, he's dealing with a partially torn pec. So you're talking about with the Rams playing ascending defensively, totally different against the Cowboys. Man, if they can make that an advantage, man, against the Saints, now you're talking about if I knew that, then I would make the Rams a huge favorite, because the dominant team in the trenches, man, has a huge advantage in these games.
And you mentioned it. The Sheldon Rankins injury is a big one for New Orleans. I know we weren't talking about the New Orleans defense, but when we do, that was a big loss they suffered in the divisional round.
All right, we got to take a break. Coming up, will Tom Brady and the Patriots silence the doubters in Kansas City on Sunday? That is ahead on First Things First. Welcome back to First Things First. Former NFL head coach Eric Mangini is here.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
What's the smirk for?
Now
coach?
Television
happy
diva.
To be here.
Television diva. Got new threads on.
It looks good.
We're about to talk about someone who's high maintenance, so we bring in
someone who's high maintenance.
Yes, I am.
When I think
I'm
Coach Mangini, I think high maintenance. There's a lot of talk about Antonio Brown's future after the way the Steelers season ended, you know, with him not playing in their last game because he walked out of practice there last week. Seems unlikely he will be back with the Steelers. Jerry Rice says AB wants to be with the 49ers, and now Bruce Arians, Tampa's new head coach, says he sees, quote, too much diva in the star wide receiver. A lot of takes here, coach. What do you think the challenges that present itself in bringing a guy like AB into a locker room?
Well, the challenge is first for the Steelers is letting him go. When you've got a guy that is as talented as he is, the idea of giving him to another team or trading another team, it makes you sick, and you want to be able to figure out a way to make it work with the group that you have. And he makes Ben Roethlisberger better. He is an elite player, and he's created a lot of issues there. But it's really hard from a head coaching perspective or from a GM or ownership perspective to get your head around the idea of letting him go or moving on from him. Now, that being said, it's a little bit like a disruptive kid in a classroom where, from a coaching perspective, you have to spend so much time with that student that you neglect a lot of other guys, and you don't get to put the time into the plan that you would want to with other people. And at what point does that become greater than the value he has on the field?
So let's, if we can, almost disregard the first piece of it. Let's just say in a hypothetical, because you always say, I forgot who told you, that if you want to be a head coach, if you want to pick the players, become a GM, if you want to pick the GM, own a team, I'm misquoting it, but
in the range.
Okay, so let's just, Art Rooney II has come out and said, it looks like he might not be on the team. If the owner says move him, doesn't matter how squeamish Kevin Colbert or Mike Tomlin are about it, they got to listen to their owner. If you are, what type of environment, what type of team do you think would be best suited to take on Antonio Brown, the good and the bad?
Well, it depends on Antonio Brown's approach when he gets to that team. Like, New England has historically taken on guys that have been challenging in other environments. And because the locker room is mature, because the majority of the guys are pushing in the same direction, because there's always a chance to win the Super Bowl, a lot of time those guys will come back in line, or they'll fit in with the group because they're looking down the line towards a chance to win a Super Bowl. You see what happens we've seen what happened in LA with the Rams, where they brought in a lot of guys that would be considered challenging. They're fine. It's fine when you're winning. Those guys become a real issue if you hit a rough patch. Mm-hmm. That's when it all implodes.
Yeah, DeSean Jackson, Tampa Bay. Mm-hmm. Now, he doesn't want to be there. When you talk about wide receivers like that, Coachman makes a good point. The winning is very, very important, and their overall productivity. Because wide receiver, they're about a couple things. Number one, they're about their numbers. Number two, they're about their money. I like the fact that you brought up New England from a culture standpoint, because I believe that New England, they made a trade for Josh Gordon, didn't they? Didn't they trade a fourth or fifth rounder for him?
Fifth rounder.
Right? Yeah. Okay, so Antonio, given the number he has, he is the type of player that New England is a perfect trade for them. Because I don't think he's going to get a one. But he has a cap number for the next 3 years, because as long as Tom Brady is there, they're going to be in a win right now mentality. So I think New England is one of the viable landing spots for him. And I believe it's probably one of the better spots, because the expectations of him when he comes into the building will be totally different if he goes somewhere. Kyle Shanahan, I got a lot of respect for how he coaches, but he doesn't command the respect on day number one that Bill Belichick and players in the transition. I don't know what's in the paperwork. I don't know what it is, but somehow, no matter what city they're coming from, on their way to New England, they make a transformation. So Antonio's going to have to decide, how long do I want to be able to play this game? And he's going to have to adjust his attitude, because I'm terrified if I'm a coach bringing him in, not because of productivity. I'm terrified of what the younger players are going to see. And the younger players, if they see the behavior of an older guy who is paid and one of the league leaders and best at his position, you can believe ultimately that kid, when he gets a position in the classroom like AB has, he's going to act like AB does. So when you look at your roster, you're wondering what type of effect that receiver is going to have on your roster. So I would be careful in the places that I'm going to bring him. I also believe that Denver's a viable spot because Emmanuel Sanders is there, and I know the head coach is not having it. He's an old school coach, defensive coach, one that you like, and he's not going to have it. So I'm going to put him in a situation that it puts pressure on him to continue to change compared to accepting the behavior that we've seen in Pittsburgh.
And Chris makes a great point. It's the lessons that they teach the younger players. So if you're in a win right now mentality and you feel like you're close and you've got a mature locker room and you can incorporate a guy like that, can be a huge asset. If you've got a young locker room and you're trying to create a culture, you're trying to set things up for the long term, and you have a guy that comes in and sets a poor example that you've paid, that you've validated, you're saying organizationally, it's okay to act like this.
That's why a team that has a need that might be a fit theoretically, I don't think will be in the market for him, and that's the Jets. Because the Jets are exactly what you're talking about. They are a couple years from winning. They are trying to build a new culture around a new head coach, around their young quarterback. They do have a need at wide receiver, obviously. I know Robbie Anderson's there, but aside from him, they don't really have a true number one receiver. But you would be a team like that, you'd be worried about. Bring in Antonio Brown and what the trickle-down effect as far as on the other players. And my concern with AB is very simple. I can deal with diva. I can deal with volatile. I cannot deal with unreliable. And that's why I never would have, in a thousand years, I never thought I would be advocating for trading a player of Antonio Brown's caliber when you're as good as the Steelers, until he walked out on the team. Like, you can throw as many coolers as you want, yell at the quarterback, spike the ball in practice. I know you don't like it, but I can deal with it.
No, because they all lead to something. That's why Coach doesn't like it. Like, because they all lead to something. It's like the little kid. Man, you think they start, they don't wake up throwing spitballs. No, they graduate to that. And then the next thing you know, they're doing other things, disrupting the class. That's why Coach said, typically, if a diva wide receiver, they start off somewhere. They don't come into the league that way. All right? They start off somewhere, and it starts a lot like that. I disagree with you as far as the Jets, because if I am the Jets, and I'm trying to not be the stepbrother here in New York, I'm trying not to be the stepbrother to New England and what they do in the AFC East. I bring in a player like him because I know the head coach and the young quarterback, it's going to make both of them instantly better. I like his cap number, and it's going to bring you more optics on your team. It gets you off of Broadway and to potentially put you on Broadway. So I think the Jets are a viable spot because he needs big productivity. You know, and if I told you, that's one of the reasons I'll be able to solve his problem, because I'll get him the football. And if you get him the football, you're going to have less problems.
What does it say about a guy like Bruce Arians, who knows Antonio Brown very well, knows his work ethic, knows his productivity, doesn't want him and needs him, would be willing to pass on a guy with that talent?
Did he say he'd be willing to pass? He just said there was too much deep,
I thought. The assumption is...
I actually see that as a more viable place than New York, because there is a relationship. And if you can bring him in and say, hey, I know you, AB. We were together for a long time. I know what your potential is. This is what my expectations are here in Tampa. And you get that understanding as a head coach. The thing with Adam Gase is he had some guys that were considered divas down in Miami.
Yes.
And then he shipped them all out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for
That's
me to
true.
Think that he might be willing to bring him in. But in Tampa, if you've had a pre-existing relationship and you knew a guy before he came up, before he really made it, sometimes you can have that connection of, I'm going to help you achieve your goals. You help me achieve mine.
And I think Bruce said that in the follow-up. He said he's a different guy now than the guy that we drafted in Pittsburgh. And you're right about that intel. Typically, if I knew you before the stardom hit, you have an avenue to be able to get in there to for them to have an ear to be able to hear you.
Yeah, and they'll be open sometimes to the coaching, because you've given them that coaching before when they were a young guy. You've had that honesty that sometimes it's hard to have with someone you don't know, and now you're a star.
What is it with your positions? Why do you guys have to be so diva and jerky all the time?
Diva and jerky.
Not you, of course. Maybe there was a cup of coffee where you were, but not anymore.
Wow.
Okay. When you watch the games this weekend, watch how many times they send 10 guys out there. Watch how many times. I've seen the show without me on it. Okay. Hey, be careful what you ask for.
Coach, stick
all right,
around.
I might
take a break.
I'll leave with Coach Mangini.
Coming up.
Then what will you have?
Is the Rams off?
Oh, all of a sudden that diva stuff ain't
We're back
so
after this. Back here with Coach Mangini. Let's take a look at the NFC title game on Sunday. Saints and Rams. Rams had a dominant 1-2 punch in their ground game Saturday against the Cowboys. Both C.J. Anderson and Todd Gurley had over 100 yards as the Rams set a franchise postseason record with 273 rushing yards. Nick, you had Saints defensive end Cam Jordan on your radio show yesterday. You asked him the key to shutting down this Rams offense.
Make them one-dimensional. I mean, for most teams, it's taken to that pass away. But, you watch how Todd Gurley runs, and now you watch how effective CJ has been the last couple of games. We have to try and tighten down on the run game, make them one-dimensional.
All right, Coach, what do you think? What do you think the game plan should be for the Saints defense, and what should they expect, rather, from the Rams on Sunday?
I think the Rams need to continue along the lines that they had last week and run the ball and run the ball even if it's not as effective as they hope it is early. You look at the last game, what Saints put up, 35 points in the first half? So by running the ball, you're going to shorten the game. That's a positive. By running the ball, you're going to slow down their pass rushers. It's going to open up the play action. They were effective running the ball last game. To me, that's the starting point, but you've got to have the patience to stick with it. And it's hard against New Orleans, because if they do get up 7 or 14, you think that you're chasing. And there's that tendency to, okay, we've got to get points quickly. We've got to change our approach. And to me, that's where teams get in trouble against New Orleans, because it opens up for the pressure packages. It does turn them into one-dimensional teams. I'd say the other thing is protecting the football. You saw the play at the end of the first half where they throw an interception. I think it was about a minute and 30 seconds left. The Saints
were able to, in their first matchup.
In their first game.
Rams throw a pick late.
That mistake was huge. And it's a 10-point game. It's just so hard to overcome errors like that where you're pressing again to make a play and suddenly put yourself in a horrible situation.
And I know the Saints all year long have been a great rush defense. They finished the year number two against the run, and that's in total yards, but also top five in yards per rush allowed. So it's not just that teams were abandoning the run. It's one of the reasons teams were abandoning the run is because they couldn't successfully run. But a big part of that was Sheldon Rankins.
Yep.
And he's out. Sheldon Rankins is the D tackle, I think their best run defender on that team. Mm-hmm. That is the substantial injury they suffered in the last round of the playoffs. Cam Jordan, who was talking there, is an excellent pass rusher and I think a good run defender, but he's not, you don't look at him as his strength is one of those, he's not a 3-4 D end who's taking, no, he's a 4-3 defensive end pass rusher. And so if you are going to have success on the Saints running the football, this would be the week. And you've got not only Todd Gurley, but now CJ, who has played three games for the Saints, 422 yards in those three games. He's been over a buck 20 in week 16, week 17, and in the playoff game. So you have a legitimate dual threat run option, and it is a pounding run option with that I would imagine would take a toll on a defense just stylistically with the body that CJ Anderson has and with the power and speed Todd Gurley has.
Yeah, one thing too with the Rams that they have. Coaches always talked about continuity in organization, continuity in the coaching staff. But they have tremendous continuity, one-of-a-kind continuity on the offensive line. This year, only offensive line coaches started all 16 games. Last year, only offensive line that started every game.
That's
they have
crazy.
All their senior players on the left-hand side.
Whitworth
and Scaffold, the left guard. They got a tremendous experience there. So them going against the Saints, it should be an advantage. When you go into a dome, I played most of my career in a dome, and one of the things that we knew how teams would try to attack us, and one thing early is it's harder to be able to throw the ball in a dome on third down. So if you want to throw it, you better throw it on first or second down. So what I would do, based on all that running and CJ and Todd Gurley last week, I would come out, play action passing the Saints, and I'm throwing the ball at the weakest part of their secondary. And when you play action, it's the best pass protection. So you can pretty much sustain a maximum rush from the defense. It's the best pass protection, and that quarterback, I want him to get comfortable in the dome. What happened in the earlier season meeting, the Saints got off to an amazing red-hot start, and the Rams were chasing. They were in a panic mode. So for me, I understand running the ball. I understand eating up the clock. I understand time of possession. But play action pass is the best way to make a dent in the enthusiasm in that building and get your quarterback, get him feeling good early.
And what's great for the Rams is they've experienced the noise in there.
That does help.
They've gotten over that that first time, and they have a much better understanding of how they need to communicate, how they need to make adjustments, how they need to audible now as opposed to the first time they went in there. And the continuity in the offensive line is huge, and you can put so much of your trust into that group because they've worked together so well and for so long. And I do agree with Chris, too. It's not like their secondary has been impressive. They've struggled throughout the course of the year. So if you can attack them effectively, which most people have been able to, it's a great approach.
And this is where the offense in the league that's gotten the most headlines is the high-scoring offense, the Chiefs. But if not for the Chiefs, the Rams would be the number one offense across the board. I mean, they're second in points, second in yards, third in rushing, fifth in passing. They're second in, it's to Kansas City. This Rams offense, I know that in the playoff game it was all running. Jared Goff was basically a caretaker. They have been a prolific offense in every way, shape, and form. And a huge part of that has been the play-action pass game because people are afraid of Todd Gurley. They ran play-action on more than 50% of their pass attempts in the first playoff game. I think that's a huge part of this weekend.
And people say, oh, he's a wide receiver. He wants to throw the ball. I really believe that's the best way to attack. And also, you have to realize, when you're playing in that type of environment, we'll talk about the weather in Kansas City, but I don't think people are going to mention – playing in a dome. When you play in an NFC championship, those domes get hotter. How do I know that? I've played in a couple of them, and I played in a dome throughout my career. So watch the fatigue factor. You talked about Sheldon Rankin. What about that rotation of the Saints? That they're down one of their primary defensive linemen. So that rotation, I'm throwing the ball early, but I'm pounding it later on. It's going to be hot in that building. I was in the Superdome when the Saints played the Vikings the last time they matched up in the NFC Championship. The humidity in that game, Brett Favre game, where he threw the interception, yep. Patty Mahomes style going across of his body. So there can be a fatigue factor playing in a dome. Late in the season, you're down in numbers. We know Sheldon Rankin is going to be missed. So how do they, what does Dennis Allen do, the defensive coordinator, to put that extra guy into the rotation? And the impact, I believe, fatigue-wise, can be to the Rams' advantage if they come out and hit some of those passes early. And
I've got a fatigue factor.
It was interesting, too, to hear some of the defensive linemen talk about Sheldon Rankin's effect from a communication standpoint. How he helped those guys in terms of shifting the defensive line back and forth and eating up the offensive line and taking it off the linebackers. That part's going to be big as well.
Quickly, something you said earlier, it's hard to throw on third down in a dome. Why is that?
It's so loud. That's when the crowd
even
is going to be
the loudest.
Even
if a team has been there already
The fans are going to be loud throughout, but they are going to be
this
at their absolute loudest.
This will be the loudest the Saints fans have ever been. What time did the game start?
What? 3:30.
My man Brumley said they'll be liquored up too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No doubt.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.